Welcome to the Wicked Wallflowers Club. I'm Sarah Hawley.
And I'm Jenny Nordback.
And we have a new limerick today for a listener who left us a review. This one goes out to Marissa Gettas. I really hope I said your name right. G-E-T-T-A-S. She is a friend from Twitter whose name I realized I have never once said out loud. So my apologies, Marissa, if that was wrong. But she left a very nice review and gave me some interesting facts about her. So here is the limerick for Marissa. She's a basketball fan with a fondness for smut. She hates pets with claws but would love a nice mutt. She lives in Toronto, so we want to visit pronto. And she loves the kind of angst that hits you in the gut. So thank you again for your review, Marissa. If anyone listening wants their own personal limerick, all you have to do is leave us a review and then send us a screenshot or some proof you did it, and we will happily provide.
We're here with Elizabeth Hoyt, a New York Times bestselling author of sweeping historical romance.
We talk about her exciting new Grey Court series, which starts with Not the Duke's Darling, the secret society of wise women she invented, and where her often dark storylines come from. Without further ado, here is our interview with Elizabeth Hoyt.
All right. I am sitting here with Elizabeth Hoyt, which is super exciting. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Well, thank you, Jennifer.
Do you
prefer Jennifer or Jenny?
It doesn't. Jenny, but okay. Jennifer is my name, so that's okay too. It's hard to get mad about that. So what was the very first romance novel that you remember reading?
The first romance novel I read surreptitiously, because it was The Wolf and the Dove, which at the time seemed very, very sexy. It belonged to a friend of mine's mother, and she had it like on her bedside table, and I don't know what I was doing in their bedroom, but I saw it once.
There's an interesting part
of
this
who
story.
Knows what I was doing there. When I would visit, when I'd come over to play or whatever, because I was like 12 or 13. I wasn't that old. I would pick it up and read parts of it. So I read the whole thing eventually. And that was, it was very exciting. Very emotional. I remember that. I got really mad at the hero.
And how long did it take you to get your hands on another one after that?
I don't remember exactly. I read mostly from the library when I was that age. I also read Poldark, the series, when I was about that age, and that's not a children's book. I don't know what my mother was thinking, but it's got romance in it. But I do remember my grandmother, when I was 14 or so, she had gotten a free Harlequin Presents. She used to read Reader's Digest. I think she got a free it from that, and she brought and gave it to me, and that was my first Harlequin, first Presents, and that was very gripping as well. featured an alpha male who had like kidnapped the heroine and forced her into marriage.
One of those. I think my first was like pretty dubious when it came to consent, but
this was very dubious.
That was like kind of exciting at the time, and I mean that was a sign of the time, like it that was you could get away with that then, and we're about it now, but yeah. That's funny. And so I was reading in your bio, your path to publication or to professional writerdom is kind of a meandering, interesting one. And I think it would maybe make some people
just very
feel better.
Belated. And, I didn't know what I wanted to do when I grew up. I keep on telling my younger daughter, who's 22, that because she doesn't know either.
Yeah.
So I didn't know what I wanted to do. Even all through college, I majored in anthropology, which is a totally useless major, by the way. I mean, it's fun to study, but kind of not very useful.
I have an archaeology degree, so
My husband's an archaeologist. That's what I got from that. My husband was an archaeologist. He's got a PhD. That helps. And where was I? So I knew I wanted. I actually fell in love with my husband senior year, and we got married after I graduated. And I knew I wanted kids, so I said, "Okay, I'll have kids." Well, I'm still trying to figure out what I want to do when I grow up. And I remember years ago going, "Well, maybe I should be a landscape gardener." So I like, gardening. But I had to go back to school for that. Like, everything had to go back to school. And about 35, I think I got to the point where I was like, fuck it. And I just, I said, I'm going to take a couple of years and try to write a book. And my husband, who had taken forever to get his PhD, like forever, was and has always been very supportive.
That's good.
Yeah.
That makes all the difference. And so was that first book, did that actually get you published?
Yeah,
or
it did. It was The Raven Prince. It took me 3 years to write because I start out the wrong position. I start out way in the wrong place in the book. Went to my first RWA conference and went, oh yeah, I have to throw out the first three chapters. And basically learned as I was writing. So it was, there's a learning curve to writing, you know, how you keep the reader's interest and how you have a plot and stuff. Yeah.
Well, and that's interesting. That first book, you were sort of practicing your craft and like putting what you were learning into effect.
Yeah, yeah.
And then that led to publication. And it was successful right out of the gates, right?
It didn't hit any bestseller list, but yes, it was successful. It's still in print. It's always been in print. And a lot of people still name it as their favorite book of mine, which is a little like, I'm glad they have a favorite book, but on the other hand, it's like my first book.
Yeah.
Nothing since then is better. Oh, okay.
That's got to be kind of strange as an author because you're like, yeah, like you feel like your craft has changed and grown and you've maybe gotten better, and like that they still cling to that one. Mm-hmm, it's kind of odd, but nice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it featured a guy who's ugly, and I think a heroine who was plain. So I think, and she was older too. So I think that later on I was told I wasn't supposed to do any of those things. But at the time when I was writing, I didn't know that. But I think that hit a lot of accord with a lot of readers.
Mm. Yeah, you know? I could see that. You worked on like an archaeological dig at some point as well, right?
For summers I used to do archaeological survey in Wisconsin. And not a dig. It's just awful. You just, you tromp along and dig holes. I was really fit though, I have to say.
Yeah.
That really sweated off the pounds. And I was the only one in my crew who didn't get Lyme's disease. So yay me.
Oh.
And part of college, I was on an archaeological dig in southwestern Wisconsin. That was actually a fairly big site in a cornfield. And that's where I met my husband. Oh. He was the guy who was doing his thesis on it.
So you actually met during the dig?
Yeah, I thought he was a jerk because he was kind of like striding around frowning a lot because this was his thesis.
That's so funny.
But then I met him again later that winter and he was much more relaxed. So
that's good.
Yeah.
And then you started dating from there. And
Well, he's a very shy, he's one of these shy academics. Although he doesn't teach right now. But anyway, we were doing a lab. So I was drawing and cataloging various artifacts. And he was supervising that. And he would say, like, you know, a couple months in, he said, you know, I'm not giving you the grade on this. And he would say, it was like, you know, his hint that he wasn't giving a grade, so therefore we could date. And then he started saying things like, well, you know, we should go out sometime. And then finally I said, well, how about this Thursday? Because otherwise I think we'd still be sitting there with him going, you know.
It was going to take him that long to actually really say
it. Work around to actually saying something, yeah.
Are you an extrovert?
No, especially at that time. I'm sorry about that.
Oh, no, you're okay. Do you want to grab it?
No. My phone's going off and it's got Spock saying, Captain, I suggest a Vulcan mind probe.
Yes.
Sorry.
I think we're going to have to leave that in. That's too telling. We were, who is it? Maureen Lelanker is a friend. She writes for Entertainment Weekly. She reviews romance for Entertainment Weekly. Mm-hmm. And she recently got to interview Ben Whishaw. Is that how you say his last name? He's like her ultimate crush of all time.
He's one of my favorite actors since I saw The Crown, and he was like the flamboyant, I can't remember which king he was, but he made him laugh
at some point during the interview. Oh. And we were like, you're going to have to cut that and make it your ringtone. It's going to have to be it. Okay, so where were we? We were how you started dating your husband. And then I asked if you, because it sounds like you described him as the shy academic. Are you more
of
an extrovert?
Yeah, he's definitely an introvert. And I, at the time, was fairly introvert. I've become more extrovert since then. I'm kind of middle. I can, you know, be with people without breaking down crying.
That's good.
But I mean, at the same time, I'm pretty much an introvert in that I like being by myself and writing.
Yeah, that's good. Okay, so there's that first book, and it's mm-hmm. it does well, but you say it didn't hit any of the bestseller lists. Mm-hmm. And then since then, you've hit bestseller lists numerous times and yeah. are, you know, considered a mega successful romance author.
I don't know if I would say mega.
Well, I said it. So I guess I always wonder with authors like you, like, is there a point where you felt like, all right, I am a real author now? Like,
yes, because so way before I was published, I was in a RWA local chapter, and they said, well, put down your goals. And I think my long-term, you know, you're supposed to put immediate goals and then, you know, five-year plan or something. And my long-term goal was to make enough money to it be a job, basically, you know. And they all said, well, you can't do that. That's too much money. You're not going to make any money like that.
As an author, what
and
are you thinking?
So I think it was my second or third. I think it was my third. There was a definite a contract I got that was enough money. And I remember just knowing that was it. You know, I had made enough money that I was actually, this was my job, you know.
And then from there, like hitting bestseller lists and those moments.
It was
like,
all icing after that.
Yeah.
I used to, I'm not quite so giddy now, but I used to be really giddy because it seemed so unlikely that first of all, that I'd be published. But that second of all, I become a professional romance writer. I mean, it sounds like you're saying, you know, I am a professional lion tamer or I'm a professional astronaut. Things that you think people will think about, but you don't actually ever do. And, you know, I'm making a living at it. And yeah, I get giddy about it sometimes because it's just so silly.
But awesome. How do people react to that? Like family or friends or people you meet?
Oh, the family doesn't care one way. My father, you know, likes to introduce me that way.
this is my professional romance.
No, that I've hit the New York Times. He, you know, that's very big for him.
Yep.
He did, of course, when I first couple of years, he picked up one of my books. I think it was the first time I hit. He's like, really? Who's reading these books? He was like flabbergasted that enough people were reading them that they, you know, I'd get on the New York Times. And since then, you know, once in a while, he's like, he's just confused about why this would be, you know, a viable living, basically.
But so funny.
Usually when I tell, I don't usually tell people because, but once in a while I'm recognized or my name is recognized and usually they're pretty excited. And I forget that there was a point where I was like that, where it was, you know, you had these names in your head all the time because you read them.
Yeah.
You know, Julia Quinn and Stella Cameron. I remember, you know, Lisa Kleypas. And then you, if you actually saw them, it was like, you know, you'd whisper around the corner, I saw her. You know,
and so, you are that now, like, you know that, right? Like, I just
it
went,
it still feels kind of silly,
yeah. Like, sorry. I just went to meet, we're at a conference right now, and I just went to meet Elizabeth downstairs at the elevators, and we're all wearing badges with our names on them. And I can see people reacting to you as they walk past, like, everyone's kind of checking names out on badges, and they're like, oh, that's Elizabeth. Like, there's a sort of buzz that happens as they walk past you. So.
I don't notice that,
but. It's happening. And I mean, is imposter syndrome any part of that, or do you feel pretty secure in
I your feel craft secure as in my craft. I don't necessarily feel like I'm a celebrity or anything, unless I'm something, you know, someplace like this, because the vast majority of people don't actually read a book. And of the people who read, you know, only a few read romance. And then of those, only a certain percentage are going to be reading me. So, you know, most people don't know who I am. So that's fine. But in terms of imposter syndrome, no, I feel like I'm, you know, I'm a writer.
Yeah.
I'm a professional writer. So, yeah.
And then how many books do you have out at this point?
I don't know. That's a good question.
I love that you don't know.
Over
that's
20.
Great.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
And like, as far as new ideas continuing to come, do they just continue to come to you and you have a whole stockpile?
I think the problem with ideas is you always, I remember vividly when I was first writing, that I was worried I was going to die before I finished all my ideas, got some of these ideas down on paper, because there's a never ending stream of ideas, some of which you can use and some of you can't. But ideas are never the problem, for me anyway, or characters for that matter. Plot's always kind of a problem, but ideas, characters, those are fine. Yeah.
And so let's talk about your newest book, uh-huh. which is Not the Duke's Darling.
Yes.
And it is Freya is the heroine, mm-hmm. and Christopher Renshaw, the Duke of Harlow, mm-hmm. is the hero. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, speaking of weird ideas, so my last, the main lane, I had at one point, I had a cabal of rich guys who were doing awful things. They were kind of like the...
Yeah, we're going to talk about that.
Oh, we are? Okay.
I have some questions.
But I kind of, because of political stuff happening in the greater world in America and other things, I got to the point where I was like, fuck it, I'm going to write a feminist. Not just one feminist, but an entire group of feminists who are living in Georgian England. Of course, they don't call themselves feminists. But basically, I just thought it would be interesting to put them there, to put a really strong woman in there, and to have this, I saw it as a group of women who are almost, they're not in a cult, but they're like in a centuries-old women's, it's called the Wise Women, women's circle that's secret, they act in secret, and they try to help other women. But because they're also, you know, within any organization, you have political stuff, so I'm also going to have stuff within it, you know, people, different ideas of what they want to do and how they're going to work, because they also have enemies, which are the Dunkelders, who are witch hunters, basically. They think they're literally witches who with powers. They aren't. This is a straight historical, there's no paranormal in it, but any woman in position of power, that's what they think they are. And they also have a lot of knowledge of childbirth and women's health and that kind of stuff.
Heaven forbid.
So, yeah, exactly. Right. So there's one part of this, you know, section who are like, we need to get out and work on parliament, work on. And the other one's like, no, we need to hide away in Scotland and just, you know, be safe from these guys.
What would the danger from men like that be at that time? So I'm assuming
burning
we're like
at the stake.
Are we really still in that, like the
Georgian
period?
Yeah, actually, I mean, I fudged a little bit. This takes place in 1760. So they had pretty much stopped doing that by then. But the last time they had done it was like 1727 or something like that. So it wasn't
not that
really
far out.
Yeah, that's a generation before.
That's wild.
So if you were living a generation after, if you knew people who had been scared of this, it wouldn't be out of the bounds of probability that this might happen again, right? So this is a real fear that they're going to start witch hunting again and literally burn people at the stake. So yeah.
So wanting to hide away in Scotland is a reasonable.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it's not what you're fighting for. And
Yeah. I mean, it just depends on the woman. So Freya is actually working in kind of undercover, sort of. I couldn't use the word undercover because that's not a historically correct word. but she's like getting information in England, because that's what the seat of, you know, London, a seat of power, and finding out what the parliament's doing. And they're about to, she knows there's a sect of men that are thinking about putting in a new witch act. Because at this time, they pretty much decide they weren't going, you couldn't torture people for witchery. These guys are like, no, I think we should go back to that. And so she knows she has to do something about keeping this act from being brought before Parliament.
This
right?
is disturbingly familiar.
It is a little
all
bit,
sitting
isn't
here
it?
Going
yeah.
like, no, we're past this. And
you know, I was recently watching a commercial with Margaret Atwood, and she was saying that everything in the Handmaid's Tale was based on things that have really happened before. So everything that... And the Dunkelders are based in a real, it's actually a religious section. The witch, you know, Wise Women, I think, could totally be real and just be under the radar we never hear about, because they aren't the people writing history, right?
I mean, we barely hear about women historically doing
exactly.
anything anyway. So,
these are, and I have them, I thought in my own mind, I don't think I ever actually bring it up in the book, but that they are descended from Druids. Mm. So, and the Druids didn't have a writing system. So... It's a very long history of being secret and keeping the knowledge to themselves.
So what is Freya up to when we meet her?
Freya, okay, so she's working as a companion to a lady and her two grown daughters who are going into society. And that way she can go to society balls and kind of get the gossip and stuff. When the book opens, she finds out that she's going to be recalled to Scotland, because that sect has taken, that part of the Wise Women have taken over and said, we're going to all retreat. And she's like, well, I can't do that. I got to bring down this one guy. It's summertime, so Parliament's in recess. Before fall, I need to figure out some way of, you know, blackmailing him or something. And his wife died under mysterious circumstances. So she says, she talks a person who's she's employed by into going to a house party near the guy who's gonna, the bad guy who's gonna put this act before Parliament. So she's searching for a way to find out what happened to his wife, if she can hold it over him. But then she runs into the Duke, who happens to be one of two guys who stood by and let her brother be beaten so badly he lost his right hand. So in addition to the witches, and not witches, but wise women in this book, I also have a family tragedy going on between three different families where a young girl died mysteriously, and the brother was supposed to elope with her when they're like teenagers, and he gets beaten nearly to death for that. And she blames the Duke, who she knew as a child, and among other things, he doesn't recognize her, which really pisses her off. But he's also wearing the ring that belonged to her brother, so she wants that ring back.
Yeah, flag to the bowl, like she's... Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so we've got kind of an enemies to lovers setup.
Yes, very much so. So at first, you know, he can't figure out what her problem is, that she's so hostile towards him. And when he does finally figure it out, he's by that point kind of interested in her and trying to figure out if there's any way they can work this through.
So, and he is not actually a villain, is he?
No, the Duke, no, he's not. He was 17 when this happened.
Okay.
He stood by. His friend said, well, we can't interfere. And so he's regretted this like his entire life, that he made the wrong decision. He should have helped. Ran is the name of the brother. He should have helped Ranulf. And he didn't. And he stood by. So he wants to be responsible from now on and not stand by when bad things happen.
But it sounds like Freya is a pretty fiery heroine.
She's pretty independent. So a lot of the conflict between them is she knows what she's doing. And she's like, I don't need you really at all. And he's like, but I'm going to, you know, protect you and save you because I need to. And then there's a later on about trust. There's a whole thing in here about marriage. So he wants to marry her. And she's like, well, at this time period, you give up all of your rights, money, everything. And she doesn't know if she can trust anyone to do enough to do that. So,
which makes perfect sense.
Yeah. I mean, so it's a lot about, it's almost a modern thought, but it's, I think I've done pretty well in the time period of what, how two people can compromise and live together.
Yeah.
Figure out a way of doing that.
And so what comes next? What's next in the series here?
So the next one is, so she's got a friend in this one called, whose name is Melissa Graycourt. The Graycourts were the ones who beat up her brother. So there's also a thing going in where she's, Melissa and Freya were besties when they were really young, and then this tragedy happened and broke them apart. And so this is also reuniting with friends, because I think that's really important, female friendships. And so actually the hero kind of is a catalyst for that. It says, you know, she really, it's not her fault. It was her brother. They both were 12 or something like that. So they become friends again. And the second book, she is called to her uncle, who is the evil bad guy. I don't think I'm giving away too much for that. By the uncle's henchman, whose name is Gabriel Hawthorne. He's kind of like, yeah, he's a henchman. He's the fixer. He does things to, you know, fix for him. And he's ready to like leave the uncle's employment because the uncle's a jerk. But the uncle says, I want you to do this one last thing for me. And he says, no, no, no. And finally the uncle says, well, if you do, you can marry my niece. And he says, okay. So the beginning of the book is a forced marriage between her and this guy.
These are such good tropes.
I hope so, yeah.
Do you have favorite tropes to read or to write?
I do like marriages of convenience because, first of all, it's easier for writing because they have to be together. Yeah. So you have to figure out a way why they're together. But I do like that. I do like the enemies to lovers, too, as well.
Big into enemies to lovers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And who do you read? Like, who are your go-to authors? That's always a big pressure.
The moment I'm reading Agatha Christie. But in terms of historical romance, I've read Christina Dodd, although she no longer writes historical, I love her. Lisa Kleypas, Julia Quinn, all those people.
Who is your favorite Lisa Kleypas hero? This has been a heated debate recently.
I know. It's not Derek Craven. Dun, dun, dun.
Good. That's not the right answer. Sarah McLean.
Oh, Sarah McLean likes her the most?
Yes.
Yeah, well, most people do. And I do like that book. But I really like the Big Huge, because something about Big Huge guys. Bow Street Runner is one of my favorites.
Oh, who is that?
And that book is so full of tropes that are just ridiculous. There's twins, there's amnesia, there's, you know.
Oh, which book is that?
He pulls her out. Have you read it?
Yeah, I need to read. Every time someone brings up their favorite,
really
I feel
bad
like I need
with
to
her names, her titles. But he fishes her out of the Thames, mm-hmm. and mistakes her for her bad twin or so. I can't. It's been a while since I read it.
Yeah.
But so she's like, what? Because she's got amnesia. And he's like surly and stomping around.
Excellent.
So, always a good thing, certainly, in stomping around.
Yeah. No, I'm a Cam girl.
That's more recent, yeah.
Yeah.
Is that so evening or afternoon or
Mine Till Midnight.
Yeah.
I do know the title of that one. Uh-huh. So he's like the gambling hall. He like manages the gambling hall for St. Vincent, who is another favorite of a lot of people.
Oh, yeah. Wait, that's not as recent as I'm thinking.
It's not. Because I read it in like college and it's been out for a little while. So,
okay, yeah.
I mean, it's been at least 10 years.
Yeah.
So
she does very good, I think, working class. And there's also another one where the guy was a former boxer and he's trying to get some, he's has a lot of money for some reason. And he's trying to bring himself up in society and mm-hmm. she's hired to help him.
Yeah.
That's a good one in terms of like, there's like a really long period of sexual tension going on between them where they don't even touch or anything. It's really very well done.
I'm going to have to look up what these ones are and put it in the show notes because we're going to make people nuts just sitting there like, tell us the title.
Which one? I don't know. I mean,
don't tease us.
I probably could find it for you, but yeah. That's a good one though. He's also a big guy.
I'm into the big guys too.
Yeah.
My husband's 6'5". I don't know if that's something to do with it or.
That's pretty big, yeah.
If I'm into him because he's 6'5".
But I'm into all the guys. So I have a tendency, my heroes have a tendency to go between, not small, but like average height to big. Yeah.
Okay, so going back to what I said we were going to go back to, mm-hmm. you've got some pretty dark themes going on in some of your recent mm-hmm, books. Mm-hmm. And like, I guess you were going to explain that sort of subplot.
Well, So there were these guys who were called Lords of Chaos.
This is in Maiden Lane, right?
Maiden Lane, yeah. Towards the end of Maiden Lane, where it's a secret society of guys who get together a couple times a year and rape people, basically. They're awful. And that sounds so out there. But then you look at stuff like the Penn State things, you know, where they were rich men who were abusing boys and no one did anything about it. And it's like, well, yeah, that could happen.
Yeah.
Especially in a time period when the rich weren't really prosecuted for things at all. So the last three books in the Maiden Lane, they're all Duke books, deal with bringing them down and trying to stop them.
And so it's
from
like
hurting people.
They're just super, super dark. Like that's just such dark subject matter, but
it gets dark, but I hope it's not, I mean, it's not depressing.
No, not at all. And it, I think, makes it that much more satisfying because there's so much at stake when they do get brought down, or like you're just so rooting for the people who are trying to bring them down. Mm-hmm. So it works in that sense. But I think I had wondered when I was reading them, like where that came from for you. Like if you had read something when you were researching.
It was mainly that a couple of really high profile pedophiles came out that who had been in society. The guy in England, what's his name? He looked really weird, but he was a TV personality.
I know.
And if
this,
you read what he did, it's just like, how could people not know this was happening?
Or
they didn't do anything. Yeah. Well, and there were several times when people went to the police and police were like, oh no, that couldn't happen.
Yeah.
You know, Jimmy Savile. That's it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it just, I don't know. I just thought it was interesting. And I like the idea of being a secret society of bad guys.
Yeah.
That's always kind of fun. It's kind of Sherlock Holmesian, sort of.
Yeah, well, and you're giving then this sort of bigger mission to your characters.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, you've still got those tropes that we talked about of like marriage is convenience or life still goes on for them and they're getting married and whatever, but in the background there's this big menacing plot that has to be dealt with.
Yeah, it gives the hero some really good motivation. right? That they have to bring him down or have to, actually in Duke of Sin, he didn't feel like he had to get bring him down. In Duke of Sin, he had to figure out why he should do that.
Duke of Sin, let's talk about that. And that, I'm not mistaken, we open with, like, he is about as just like debauched as you can possibly be.
He's not debauched in the very first scene. In the very first scene, he's clothed. There is a picture of him, of painting on the wall, that I think larger than life, of him naked that he had painted. But yeah, the second scene where you see him, he's with two prostitutes in his bed. So yeah, he's debauched.
And like he's does his best to be like a bad dude, but obviously you redeem him in the end.
I sort of redeemed him. He's still a villain. What I did was, because he'd been seeing, I don't know how many books I had him in before, so people were waiting for him.
Yeah.
And I do get irritated when you get the villain or the guy who's got a certain personality, and when you get to his book, he just turns vanilla.
Yes.
So I kind of wanted to deal with what would it be like if this guy had no moral compass and was a duke and could do whatever he damn well pleased, right? He had no checks or balances on him. And the checks become the heroin, saying, "You no, you can't do that. That's bad."
Yeah. And that's Sarah, who loves you and is going to be really sad that she wasn't here. And I have talked about this at length, and it was refreshing for us for that reason, because mm-hmm. I think we both have such a villain complex. Like, I'm always...
Oh, I love villains. Like, yeah.
That's who I'm attracted to. And often in stories, I'm like, I want that guy's story. Yeah, and yeah. You don't always get it. But then sometimes you do get it, and it's not satisfying because I've been waiting for it and waiting for it. And yeah, he's suddenly not a villain anymore. It's like, oh, no, he's a big teddy bear. And you're like, no, I like him because he's a villain and he's complicated. Mm-hmm. And I don't want that to be lost just so that he can have a happily ever after. Like, obviously, there's a fine line, but you managed to find it. So
yeah, I hope so. I hope so. Yeah, he was actually his book. He's actually the villain of his book. And if you look at it, the guy who's in Duke of Pleasure, Hugh, is actually the hero. If you look at what goes on in the book.
Yeah.
But the book's not about him. It's about the villain. So.
Yeah. And it's refreshing. Is that something that you would want to explore again, or
villainy?
Being able to turn that on its head.
Well, I've got the third book in this, which has no name. Wait, man, I think it does have a name, but I can't remember what it was. Anyway, and I haven't started writing or anything. We'll have a guy who has very dubious morality and doesn't know how to deal with it.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Do we get to know any more than that?
Yeah, it's Melissa's brother, the Duke of... Well, he's not a Duke right now. But yeah, he's
Is he the one who did the beating?
No, but he stood by.
He was the one who stood by. Yeah,
and I can't say why. I'll be giving away way too much for saying why he stood by.
I'll get a few drinks in her later and find out.
But he's not good. He's kind of ambiguous.
Oh, but I like that. These are very complicated themes. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it is nice sometimes to read books that don't go to that depth, but I think this is my preference, where it's really complex and you've got to grapple with it a little bit as a reader.
I like characters who are deep, who have layers to them. Yeah.
Do you connect with your characters in such a way that they're sort of real to you?
They're real to me that they don't talk to me. I hear about people who, their character, that seems weird to me. I'm manipulating them, not the other way around. But they are real enough that there's been several books where I get to a point where I've plotted it or whatever. I don't do very much plotting anymore because it's just useless. and I look at the character and go, no, he wouldn't do that. So I have to rewrite it, you know. But yeah, they're real enough to me that I know what they would do in whatever situation, because they should be different than other, hopefully, characters. Shouldn't all react the same, you know?
And is that something that you are finding ever now that you've had so many books out? Like, do you start conceiving of a character and then realize, like, that's exactly like Hugh from another book?
I do, sort of. I mean, I sometimes they're tropey and I'm like, oh, that's a little bit close. So let's see how we can make them a little bit different.
Yeah.
And I wonder, I've always wondered if that is actually because I use different heroes, whether that's actually keeping my career back, because a lot of the big name authors have heroes that are very similar and we love those heroes. Yeah. Right. But they use the same hero again because people like it. They know what they're going to get. Whereas I like different guys. I want to see the guy who's, you know, quiet, and I want to see the guy who's so full of verbal. I actually do like the guys who talk a lot. And you know, the big guy, the little guy, the guy who's, you know, from different backgrounds. Yeah. That's the other thing. I do like working class guys and,
yeah,
you know.
And when you're thinking of these plots and these characters, mm-hmm. how are they coming to you? Like, is it usually a character, like you, the heroine
It's
first?
Characters. It's always okay. character based. And then I have to figure out. So like what I just told you about the second book, which I think is When a Rogue Meets His Match, something like that. Anyway, so I knew from the very beginning that it was the bad uncle's henchman. And I knew that's going to be Melissa. I kind of knew what Melissa was like. His character, though, is kind of evolving as I go into it. So I may actually go back. I'm in copy edits for Not the Duke's Darling. I may tweak him a bit because his character is a little bit more complex than I originally thought he was, which is good. I like that. So it's character based. I want her with a guy who came up from the streets, and his ambition is basically driving him because he doesn't want to ever be, you know, without food again, basically.
Which is fair.
Yeah.
So backing up a little bit to like those early days of your career, I think I read in your bio that like motherhood kind of took the front seat for a little while.
Yeah.
Which it does for so many of us. Is that something you were still juggling when you started writing?
Yeah. I started writing when my youngest daughter entered kindergarten. So when she was 5. But it was really nice because before that I was a full-time mom. Mm-hmm. And I could stay home with her. And those were lovely days. We used to have like peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. And then we'd go get the mail. And then we would spend like 2 hours at Myers. I don't know if you've seen Myers. The Myers is a big, huge, it's a box grocery store.
Okay.
They had like guinea pigs there. So we would spend all this time looking at the pets, and then we'd go buy something. And then, anyway, it was just totally unstructured and fun. And then my mother said, you know, really, are you ever going to get a job? And I was like, okay, I guess I should do something. Which, unfortunately, what I thought I should do was sit down and write a book for the next 3 years. But anyway.
Not quite what she had in mind.
Yeah. But yeah, they were little. I remember when I got my agent. So I'd queried a whole bunch of people and mostly got rejected, all that kind of stuff. So the woman who's going to be my agent called as I was driving from Minneapolis to Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, which is where we lived at the time. And I don't know why my husband wasn't there. I mean, he was working. My two girls who were like 9 and 11 or 12 or maybe younger than that were in the car. So I stopped at a gas station. I gave them a 20, which at that time was a lot of money, and said, you can get whatever you want inside. And I remember talking on the phone with, and deciding I wanted her as an agent while my kids were in front of the car because I was parked against, you know, nothing, doing a little jig with candy in their hands.
So fun that that's the mental image that'll always be tied to that moment for you. Like, it's such a big moment.
Well, and the cutest part was they brought me change. They didn't actually use the entire $20.
That's a moment when you know you've done your job.
Yeah.
They're good girls. Oh, I just totally lost my train of thought. No, I don't know what I was going to say anymore.
Motherhood? You were talking about motherhood and juggling motherhood.
No, I think it was about something to do with your agent and publication. No, it'll come back to me.
Okay.
And so, like, that 3 years when you had decided, like, okay, this is my job.
Mm-hmm.
Was that hard at all? Like, did you feel like giving up or?
I didn't feel like giving up. What I felt was that, and I still feel, saying you're going to write a book is a bit like saying I'm going to become an astronaut and go to the moon. It's like, okay, maybe, but until you do it, I'm not going to believe you.
Yeah.
So I didn't tell anyone that I was doing this, besides my husband, obviously. And I would go in and write at a coffee shop. And I think as, you know, months went on, I started doing it more regularly and stuff and started realizing, you know, like I said, it's a huge learning curve. But the first time I went to RWA, which was in Denver, by the way, so I had joined RWA. I'd been writing for, you know, a year or two at least. And, you know, I decided I was going to go to the conference, which also was a big financial thing for me to do. And my husband's like, sure, I'll stay here with the kids. You drive out by yourself. And I was like, okay. I was just scared to death. And it was interesting. So I went out there. I came, and then I came back, and my mother calls me up. I think I told my mother and my sister, and she said, "Look, you need to tell your dad because he thinks that you're leaving Fred, who's my husband."
Oh my gosh.
Like, really? You think it's a midlife crisis? And I went to Denver. But he couldn't think of any other reason I would drive out to Denver by myself.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. You left the kids and you're getting out of there.
Yeah, yeah. So I had to confess to my father that I was writing a book and interested in writing. And then, so he was like, "Oh, he's so supportive." And then I actually published and he was like, "What?" I was expecting that.
And then, yeah, you hit the bestseller and he was like, "Oh, you're legit."
But who's reading these books? Yeah. I don't understand.
Who are these people? I mean, we all have those moments. I see books sometimes on there. I'm like, really? Like, who? This has a big audience, but and it's great.
He's really funny. He'll tell me, he's such a goof. He's very outgoing and people really like him. He's 91 now. There's a local independent bookstore, which is very literary. It's very small and literary. And he went in there and must have told the guy who I was, and I was his daughter. And the guy, the owner, looked at my books on his computer and said, "She's very prolific." That was what he said. And my dad's like, "Well, that means he really likes it." I'm like, no, that doesn't. Not really.
Funny. Yeah. I love stories of like supportive parents going to stores and like insisting on telling anyone who will listen, like, this is my child's book. Like, it's the best. But, and those are great. And I feel like we hear that a lot more than I get the like, "My parents are ashamed of me," or "I can't tell them that I write romance." Like,
I hope so, because that's really awful if someone, I mean, as a mother, you know, my kids would have to do something really atrocious for me to be ashamed of them and not supportive of what they're doing, you know? Yeah.
So from that first conference where you didn't have a book out yet, you were still kind of figuring out who you were.
I had to, you know, throw away the first three chapters.
Yeah. That is such a different experience, I'm sure, to like, how many have there been in between?
Yes, I remember the first conference I went to. So I was all by myself and I wasn't at the conference hotel. I was at a Holiday Inn nearby. And I remember I got to watch TV by myself. I had control of the clicker. This never happened at home. I don't think we had a TV at the time. I think I was one of those moms that didn't have a TV. Anyway, and I got room service. I was so excited. But I remember going into the hotel and getting on an elevator, and they did the whole looking at your name tag. Mm-hmm. And the woman there said a little aggressively, "Who are you?" And I looked at her, I said, "I'm nobody." because I wasn't.
Yeah.
You know, she wouldn't know my name. But yeah, it's changed since then.
Yeah. Well, and not just in the sense that like people know your name, but yeah, I'm sure like those connections, and now it's not.
Yeah, I see a lot of friends and
you
stuff.
You know, you don't walk down, like, it's my first RWA and, you know, I walk downstairs to pick up my badge earlier and it's like, I know nobody here. And it's just such a daunting feeling, but everyone starts somewhere. So.
Yeah, breaking into a group is hard.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. It's one of those things they don't tell you. Making friends as an adult is really uncomfortable.
It's really hard. Yeah. And you'll be going and everybody's like, you know, screaming and hugging each other. And you're like, I don't know anybody.
Well, and it's funny too, because you feel like you know a lot of people from like social media. Mm-hmm. Like you have Twitter friends, but then suddenly you're around real people and you're like, I don't know what they look like. Like, I know that their avatar is, you know, a fairy, but I have no idea what they really look
true,
like.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. And I also had I think it was that conference where I went to a special interest chapter meeting, and I sat down at the table. We were having like lunch or something, and everybody stopped talking, looked at me, and then turned away. I was like, guys, we have to do better than this.
Yeah, exactly.
So
and you have to try to be that, like, be the welcoming person that you would have wanted when you were the nobody. So yeah, that's tough. Well, we are at the point in our interview where we jump over and do a handful of rapid fire questions that are just sort of random, get to know you a little bit better. Mm-hmm. And you can give as long or as short an answer as you want.
Okay.
There's no right or wrong. The first question is, what is the strangest or most interesting object that's in your workspace?
In my workspace? Mm-hmm. Well, at the moment, I've got and I'm pretty proud of this, a Harry and Meghan mug
Ooh.
From England that my sister brought me back. and it's still in the box. She's like, why don't you take it out of the box? And I say, because it says right there, it's not dishwasher or microwave safe. I can't actually use this thing.
If you let that loose in the house, it's never going to be, it's going to be washed right off. Yeah. That's awesome. Okay. Next question. Is there anything you irrationally hate?
Well, I'm sure there is, but I can't think of the moment. I mean, besides bugs.
But bugs, I can understand.
Yeah, someone, that's not irrational.
I'm trying to think who it was said butterflies once. And I was like, okay.
No, I like butterflies. Like,
butterflies are cool. Is there anything you think you rationally hate?
Bugs.
Bugs, yeah.
Well, I mean, bugs inside the house. I like bugs outside.
Bugs are necessary, but
yeah,
not necessarily on your pillow. Okay. Well, I think we'll let you off the hook with that one.
Okay.
The zombie. That's kind of you. Because the next question is much harder, and
yeah,
I'm not going to let you off the hook. The zombie apocalypse is happening, and you can only save one work of fiction that you didn't write. What would it be?
One work of fiction I did not write. Dun, 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 dun. Well, it'd be easy to say something like Shakespeare, but that's bleh.
Yeah, right. That's what you want to preserve for humanity. Yeah.
Well, I suppose I would want to preserve Shakespeare. Actually, I'm a big Shakespeare fan, so probably, yeah. If you're talking about humanity.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would be Shakespeare.
Okay. Which work, though?
It'd have to be one work?
Yeah. One work
of
fiction.
Well, The Tempest, I think.
Oh. I feel like I would have to save Much Ado, but...
No, Tempest.
Tempest? All right. Okay, you are having a dinner party, and you have to invite three women, historical or currently living, to this party with you. Who would they be?
J.K. Rowling's, because I think as a writer, it'd be fun to pick her brain. Yeah. Oh, Eleanor Roosevelt would be fun.
Mm-hmm.
Was she shy? Do you know? It'd have to be three people who could actually talk is the problem here. And Mary Wollstonecraft. That would be great. She's the one who wrote A Vindication of the Rights of a Woman.
Oh. Yeah. I'm going to have to go look her up now.
Yeah, Mary is, she's...
It's one of those Mary fuzzy Shelley's things in the back of my mind.
Mother?
But, yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. Good answer. Okay. Would you rather be forgotten or hatefully remembered?
Hatefully remembered.
Excellent. My kind of girl. Okay. What is something that we could always expect to find in your purse or on your person? What do you always have on you besides your phone?
Lip balm.
Which is the cheating.
Lip balm.
Lip balm.
Is that cheating too?
No, that's fine.
I also have a card case. I've got my glasses. A glasses case. I always carry.
That's important.
I have prescription sunglasses.
Yeah. All right. Okay. In a game of Fuck, Marry, Kill, you have Idris Elba, Jason Momoa, and Chris Evans.
I have to kill one of those?
You have to kill one of them. I mean, if that deeply upsets you, you can send him to a desert island somewhere.
I think I would send, this is going to be controversial, but I think I would send Jason Momoa to a desert island just because I've heard him speak and I don't know if he's the brightest man in the world. He's so pretty, but I don't know if he's the brightest man in the world. And so that's fucking me. I think I'd want to fuck, Chris Evans and marry Idris Elba.
Yeah.
Maybe. Neither one of them seem like marrying types.
Yeah, I'm not getting that vibe. Which Jason Momoa kind of
does. Is a marrying type,
like,
yeah.
He seems very loyal, but I think you're right. Not necessarily the best conversationalist.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we married Idris.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. We go out to a bar together. What is your drink of choice?
Anything. This is awful. Anything that's sweet and sparkly. I like really tacky wine.
So things that like don't even really taste like alcohol and just pretty.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have
fruit
you
maybe.
Had, like they do canned sparkling rosé now.
Yes, yeah, that would be all. I'd be all over that.
And it's like it's glorious. It doesn't. It's like this. Just like very.
I can
pleasant,
tell when a
light.
Wine is bad because I like it.
Oh, that's classic.
Oh, this must be a really cheap wine. I like this.
But you don't get a headache from like the cheap shitty wine.
Mm-mm.
Oh, I'm jealous.
I don't. I don't drink much because more than half a glass, and I'm just like under the table. So.
I haven't been drinking for so long because I've just been like pregnant and breastfeeding and whatever that now I have exactly like not even half a glass. And I'm like, I think I might be tipsy. I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to go back to drinking.
So that's unfortunate.
Yeah. Okay. What Hogwarts house would you be in?
Slytherin.
Excellent.
I think I took the test and I was Slytherin.
Yeah.
My sister was Hufflepuff.
No. We love the Hufflepuffs, though. We need more Hufflepuffs. Okay, last question. Invisibility or super strength?
Oh, that's a good one. I mean, if you had super strength, you could open all the jars. So that'd be useful. I think invisibility, you could do a lot more with invisibility.
You can lurk and...
Lurk.
Which, I say lurk because I'm also a Slytherin, but we always get people who are like, I could... Oh, what do they say? Like, I could sneak into museums at night and like just the super nerdy answers where we're like, we're such nerds. We're like, yeah, you could have it all to yourself. Like, oh, we get with invisibility a lot. Yeah, like as storytellers, I think people are like, I could listen in on conversations. Mm-hmm.
Without getting too weird with them. It's like, why are you staring at me?
Yeah, like I want to know your business, but I don't, yeah. Mm-hmm. Need you to know that I want to know your business. Okay, so the new book is, and I've already lost the title, Not the Duke's Darling.
Yes.
And if people want to find out more about you or follow you online, where can they do that?
I've got a website, www.elizabethhoyt.com. I'm on Twitter a lot, more than I should be.
That's your preferred
Social media. Let's have a discussion about this. Yeah. I used to be on Facebook, and that was great because I had like people I knew, so many readers. And it's the algorithm or whatever is so messed up now that people don't. I don't think they see my posts. So yeah, default, I'm now on Twitter. I was on Twitter before, but I spend most of my time talking to people on Twitter. I'm also on Pinterest if you want to follow my boards.
Are you on Instagram?
Not really, no.
Do you have, are your boards like book related? Do
yeah.
you have like fan casts?
On Pinterest, and... I do a they have several different purposes. Because they put the cover up way before I finish the book, I'll put up color ideas I have for the book and different ideas. Sometimes I don't know why I'm pinning something, but it works out, if that makes sense. So for each book I'll have a Pinterest board.
And can we see them while you're working on them?
Yeah.
Like it's your work in progress board.
Yeah. I mean,
so
I don't think
like,
you're gonna
not I mean,
it seems like, you know, here's
one.
A ring, here's a bird. I don't see you're not gonna know what that means.
No, no, not that we would like extrapolate the plot from it and give it away, but just like it's interesting.
I think and this particular series, I've got an entire board just for the series. So that's really kind of woo woo. It's like, you know, feelings about the series, you know. I have one for characters, too. And all the women are like pre-Raphaelites and all the men are real guys. I don't know why I write that, but anyway.
So Pinterest, we'll put the links to all of that. And on Twitter, you are just at Elizabeth Hoyt?
I think so, yeah.
I'll double check that.
Yeah. But... Facebook is like Elizabeth Hoyt Books, I think. But like, again, you will never see, you know. The way Facebook is working, it's not, you can't see each other.
Yeah, it's weird. I used to be terrified of Twitter. Like, it just was overwhelming, and I felt like I didn't know what to say, and I didn't have anything to say, and it moves so quickly.
It doesn't matter. Nobody has anything to say,
and then it was
really.
Like, I think I found my community where it was like, there were enough people where I was like, oh, no, I can relax. Mm-hmm. Like, these are friends, and mm-hmm. it's fine. I can just speak my thoughts. It's
yeah.
not that pressure of, like, I have to say something witty or...
No,
particularly
I think
clever.
Most of mine are just dumb stuff. I put up dog pictures a lot, so
I feel like dog pictures you should be on the Instagram more. But
yeah, but for whatever reason, I don't.
It's not your thing.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time. I know how busy you are at the
thank
conference,
you.
But I really appreciate it.